Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Yo. Technology. What is it all about?
The internet now, I just see, is much more reflective of the real world than we saw it or we imagined it 20 years ago, when it was this very nascent, quirky little thing where it didn't have the problems of the real world because it didn't have all the people of the world.
That voice you just heard was Ev Williams, the billionaire co-founder of Twitter. I sat down with him last week to tape this episode of Danny in the Valley, but our interview happened the day before Twitter had some pretty big news. And I'm not talking about its decision to potentially up the limit for tweets from 140 to 280 characters. The company gave evidence in a closed-door session of the Senate Intelligence Committee, which is looking into how Russian operatives use social media to influence the 2016 presidential election. Twitter said it has frozen 200 Russia-linked accounts, but Mark Warner, the ranking Democrat on the committee, slammed the company, calling its presentation deeply disappointing. To quote him, Twitter showed an enormous lack of understanding about how serious this issue is and the threat it poses to democratic institutions. That public dressing down perfectly tees up the conversation I had with Williams, who's been working on this idea of online publishing and idea sharing since the late 90s, when he launched his first company, Blogger, one of the first blogging platforms. Of course, he also started Twitter, where he is no longer involved in the day-to-day operations, but remains on the board of directors and is its largest shareholder. His day job now is Medium, an online publisher that he launched 5 years ago to fix what he called the broken media. It was at Medium's office, just a few blocks from Twitter in downtown San Francisco, where I met with him last week. We had a fascinating chat about where the internet has gone wrong, trolls, why it's so hard to turn a profit from content unless you're Facebook or Google, and how the future of journalism online may depend on a quirky idea. Clapping. Yes, digital applause. Anyhow, I will let him explain. So, without further ado, here's Ev. I'd be remiss if I didn't start with the obvious. These are momentous times. 280 characters.
Yeah, I'm stoked. Long time coming.
I feel personally very excited about this.
That's good. A lot of people are upset, which I understand.
Which is interesting. Do you have any sense of why that is? I mean, 140 characters always felt so limiting to me.
I think there's a natural sense that the brevity and the constraint is where the beauty is, which is certainly something that we always believed. There was a lot of power there. We did, the 140 character constraint was for the fairly arbitrary reason to fit it into text messages. But then we were surprised that there was all this power to that constraint. And I think people associate the constraint with the power. Personally, I don't think 140 is a magic number. There's a lot of science and study that the team did that number, and it's still fairly constrained. So obviously more expressive and more powerful.
One way to kind of frame all of this is because you've been at this online publishing thing for a long time, longer mm-hmm. than most, since way back in 1999 at mm-hmm. Blogger. But I was just looking through the lens of Twitter, and then we can talk about what you're doing now at Medium. I mean, there's this idea that at the start of the internet, it was this great world-changing thing that was going to all kind of allow us to share ideas. And it's done that, but it's also become this instrument to amplify the kind of darker side of things. sitting here today, when you look at, say, Twitter, which has become like the megaphone of Donald Trump and lots of trolls, et cetera, do you find that disconcerting?
The way I look at it now, as opposed to, say, 15, 20 years ago when we were starting down this journey, and when I say we, I mean those few of us who were excited about the potential of the internet then and started building and enabling these ideas, it's just more complicated than we realized. There's a lot of emphasis on the negative side and the abuse and the misinformation, all kinds of things that are obviously not ideal. But it's important to have perspective and say that, you know what, there's incredible, amazing things that are still true, the positive side that we don't talk about because we take those for granted now. But it's not perfect. The internet now, I just see, is much more reflective of the real world than we saw it or we imagined it 20 years ago when it was this very nascent, quirky little thing where it didn't have the problems of the real world because it didn't have all the people of the world. And, you know,
it was still a niche thing.
It was very niche. And when things are small, they're manageable. And when there's bad actors, that, you know, they don't get the momentum. When there's a person with terrible ideas that wouldn't be accepted in their community, they couldn't find the 1,000 other people in the world who shared those ideas, and then they felt empowered by each other with the veil of anonymity, and the networks were also less connected and less immediate, so there wasn't the potential for abuse, and they didn't have the impact on what people read and believed and how they voted. And so now that everything is so intertwined, I think it's very obvious that while I still believe in the positive side of connecting people and enabling more people to share their thoughts, oops, also there's all these problems. Let's work on those problems.
Did you ever envision that this could become such an instrument of presidential power?
It wasn't in our design doc.
That wasn't in your decks?
No, we weren't. On the other hand, I was working on Blogger in, when would the, yeah, 2000 was a presidential election, but then 2002 was an election year, and we that was when candidates started using blogging, and it was a direct-to-the-people medium. And then with 9/11, that was sort of the eruption of political blogging that birthed many careers and tons of discourse, and took that form from a what was seen as personal and or techie field to something more political, more mainstream. Twitter is just one form of the same phenomenon of the direct communication power of the internet and all the implications of that.
So before we get to Medium, I think it would be worth, just because a lot of our listeners are overseas, to give a kind of quick potted history of what you did before Medium, which you started in 2012. So you started Blogger in 1999, is that right?
Yeah.
After you dropped out of university.
Yeah, a few years after I dropped out of university, and I kind of bounced around here in Silicon Valley, and then, yeah, I started Blogger in 1999, worked on it for 4 years, and then sold that to Google in 2003, and worked on Blogger there for a couple years, and then I left there, and I helped start a company called Odeo, which was an ill-fated, very early podcasting company. It was very early days of podcasting, and, you know, we imagined the future that we now have of this myriad options for new audio content, but it wasn't built into iTunes yet.
Right.
And so people still complain about the discovery of podcasts, but there was really nothing then. So we were trying to solve that problem as well as helping creators of podcasts. So what we envisioned was not terribly unlike Medium or lots of other content platforms, but for podcasts. Two things happened. One, it was really, really early. So it was before the iPhone. Podcasts originally came from the iPod. And the idea was you would connect the iPod to your computer, you'd download some podcasts, and then you'd walk around and listen to them. That was a lot of friction to actually get them onto the iPod, although it was possible. So part of Odeo was there was software you installed on your computer that would connect to iTunes, and so it was complicated. And then actually surprisingly early, much to our chagrin, Apple embraced podcasts. In that same year, 2005, they built podcasts into iTunes. They eliminated our major advantage that we were trying to solve. And it was still super early. No one was really listening to podcasts yet.
Right.
So that wasn't exactly a rocket ship. And that's when we started thinking about what else could we do? And we were thinking about new things. And that's where we started Twitter.
The background of Twitter has been much written about, lots of comings and goings and who was CEO, et cetera. You were CEO for a while, then you left and you started this in 2012. What's the big idea of Medium?
So the big idea of Medium is essentially very similar to the ideas of Blogger and Twitter. I mean, it's similar in the sense that it's another platform for allowing people to put thoughts and ideas out into the world. There's a different motivation. With Blogger and then Twitter, the main problem we were trying to address was simply the internet promised the ability for everybody to have a voice and put their thoughts out there. It was still hard, though. And so yeah. Blogger made it easy to set up a website and update that website in the form of a blog. Twitter made it an order of magnitude easier by eliminating the need to set anything up, eliminating the need to write much. You know, it was all about speed. At that point in 2012, after I left Twitter, I was thinking about the future and the state of the world. And one thing that was obvious was we had solved the problem of making it easy to put ideas out into the world. It was fairly momentous, and we take for granted, again, even back then, the idea of if I have a thought, I can put it out into the world if I have internet access and all that. That's now easy. But it was clear at the time that that didn't make everything automatically better. We could build on top of that. And so the question with Medium was really, how do we make things better?
I was reading before I came over here, when you set it up, you had a very pithy and pointed way of saying kind of why you were doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Saying basically it's as an alternative to what you called, quote, the highly optimized algorithm chum being slung by the truckload by low-cost content purveyors.
Yeah, that's one way to put it. It was clear to me before anyone was talking about fake news and misinformation that the systems that were driving the creation and distribution of content online were having a detrimental effect on the quality of the information we were consuming, at least on the commercial side. I look at problems as systems and what are the incentives and feedback loops that are driving behavior. What the internet had optimized for and taught people who are putting information out there, especially if they're trying to make money, but even if they were just trying to have influence and get attention, was that quantity trumped quality. And attention was the goal, and attention was rewarded, and all attention was equal. It doesn't matter if it was you're making someone angry or you're enlightening someone.
Right.
Attention was rewarded, and you got more of it if you figured out how to do that in a high quantity and low cost.
Which is why cat videos do better than a 10,000-word investigative piece on subject X.
Usually, at least for the effort. And so that seemed like that really undermined the promise of the internet, that it makes us all smarter and more enlightened and increases the understanding. And it didn't seem necessary. If we built better systems and changed the incentives, we could change the direction of that trend. That was the motivation to start Medium.
So initially, it was just a platform kind of let a thousand voices bloom. And then you tried to start with an ad-based model or a subscription and ads? Because you've had a couple pivots since then in terms of how you're trying to kind of create the business.
We've had one pivot of business model. We've always been trying to do the same thing, which is we build a platform where anyone can publish as individuals or organizations for commercial and non-commercial purposes. And the goal has been, and what we've succeeded in doing, is building a network. So if you publish on Medium, unlike a standalone website, you can tap into readers on Medium and you can build a following and you can reach an audience. And it's that network that is really the value. And this is where it's like Twitter and other things where you can build a network and build a following. The difference is you can do it with more substantive content. It's not social media. That was the initial plan. then as we started to move into professional content, we at first were working with brands to do native content and sponsored content in order to fund the creation of professional content. And that's what we decided to, that's what we were doing a year ago.
Bringing on big brands like The Ringer, et cetera, to kind of
publish. Well, there are two types of brands. We're bringing on commercial publishers like Bill Simmons, The Ringer. And then we were working with them as well as big brands like BMW and Intel and Samsung and GE to
do like advertorial.
Could do kind of, sponsor content, native content. So it was never traditional web ads, but it was brand-based publishing. At the beginning of this year in 2017, we decided that wasn't the best path. So we stopped doing that, and we, in March, launched a consumer subscription business instead.
Yeah, so I think it was in January you had to lay off some people and close a couple offices in D.C. and New York, et cetera. Right. March, you launched subscription.
March, we launched a beta of subscription, which we opened up in May. So it's been about 4 months since we've really had
$5 a month.
Yeah.
And how many subscribers do you have?
That's not information we're sharing right now.
How's it going?
It's going great. It's growing. It's growing every day. I think the growth is accelerating. What we've launched about a month ago is what we call the Medium Partner Program. The basic mechanism of the subscription, not unlike the New York Times or New Yorker or many other publications, is a paywall. So some content on Medium is behind that paywall. The majority is not. But so
there's a garden of kind of cool stuff you get to.
There's a garden of cool stuff. I like that description of it. Yeah. The vast majority of content on Medium is still free, but so we're sort of transitioning into this world where more of it is behind the paywall. And so our latest step in that was to enable writers and publications to self-publish behind our paywall.
Right.
And then we will pay them based on the engagement of their content. And the theory behind that is I'm very confident that people will pay for high-quality content. I think what's going to be hard is for every publisher to build their own subscription, let alone every author. So this is a way for people who want to put in the work to do this type of content to actually get paid with the economics of a subscription, but essentially we all work together to get that subscription to critical mass.
Right. And so you've been working on this for almost two decades. Do you think it's possible for a publisher of, let's call it quality content, to have a viable business that's solely ad-based?
No, not really. I hesitate to say it's not possible. There are people who do it now who will probably do it for a long time. In the world of publishing, I don't think there are any absolutes, especially for very niche publishers or for, you know, there's a lot of factors that play into it. Pretty much any model that you can think of will work for someone because publishing is diverse as the food industry. But the general trends will be that the market will bifurcate and there will be a free content focused on mass distribution, advertising powered, low cost production, which generally but not always means low quality, but there's certain types of content you can produce at low cost and has mass appeal. And then there's higher production value, higher cost content, which I think will generally need to be paid for by a combination of consumer supported. I'm very confident there will be a market for high quality consumer supported content as well.
Right. Do you think there's a parallel to be drawn between media or reading, for lack of a better word, and the music industry and the transition it's gone through? Because it's only in the last year that actually revenues have gone up after Napster, which came out in 1999.
Yes, absolutely. What's particularly interesting in music is that the content didn't really change, but convenience and packaging did and created incredible value proposition for consumers. For $10 a month, access to everything basically, and these incredible tools for discovery that is way better than anything you could imagine before. It's just sort of a no-brainer to pay for that, even though you could still go out and find music for free. What people say a lot about publishing is, well, people are used to getting it for free, so you'll never convince them to pay. I just think that's untrue. people will pay for things, and they demonstrate that in all kinds of markets, media and otherwise. People pay for higher quality, people pay for convenience, people pay for identity. That's demonstrated across the board.
Right. We talk about claps?
Sure.
So the system is on Medium. So if I write something, you guys introduce the clap icon next to it. And depending on how many people click that button would determine how much I get paid. Is that right?
Roughly.
Because when this came out, I saw lots of the Snark Army online came out in force.
Yeah.
I presume, having been at Twitter so long, you were not surprised.
Honestly, it caught me a bit off guard. The lack of even attempt to understand what we were doing.
The knee-jerk, this is a stupid idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I knew it was unusual. I knew it wouldn't be obvious. The degree to which people still misunderstand it surprised me a little bit. And I think certainly we could have done a better job of explaining it. But what we want to do is we want to measure value. Value not according to us, but value according to the person consuming a piece of content. Right now on the web, the way value is measured is pure attention. How many people saw a thing?
Clicks.
Clicks and views. That is value to an advertiser. It's not value to the people clicking and viewing. In the best possible scenario, you could read someone's brain and say, after they consume something, and if they looked at it and went away after 3 seconds because they realized it's clickbait or worthless, then it'd probably be no value or negative value. The web doesn't register that. If you saw an ad or a page view is registered, it's as much value as if you read something for 10 minutes and changed your view of the world. So that's obviously a terrible system and will not generate better stuff. A better system would be if you could ask them, was this good? How good was this? So was this good is actually a thing that we have on the internet. We've had for a few years. We have like buttons, and we have hearts, and we have these feedback mechanisms that say, was this good? On Medium, the system we've had, our equivalent of the like, we call the recommend. Would you recommend that this is worth someone's time? We've been studying this problem for a long time about what signals actually signify quality. And so the recommend is a good one, but in a sense, it doesn't capture variability. So what we've invented essentially is the variable like.
Because you can do one clap or 100.
You can do up to 50. There's actually a limit. And so the whole point is to say, how good was this? To do that in a way that didn't make people think about it too much and was a natural sort of reaction, it correlates with how much someone appreciates something. It's a source of data that we didn't otherwise have.
Are you surprised at how broken the media has become, or how thoroughly the internet has broken the media model?
I try not to be overly negative on it because it's disappointing, because so much is possible that we haven't yet done. There's no golden heyday where all newspaper articles were correct and you know, it should be better by now. I think we have, and that was a theme even before we were focusing on the business model that really motivated a lot of the initial ideas in Medium, which is, you know what? We really haven't changed that much. And today with machine learning, there's so much more that's possible to make this all better, but it's held back by this business model and distribution problem.
And I guess that leads to a kind of a different question, but related, is that the Medium right now, it's $5 a month, and you get to the end of every month and you just divvy up that pot.
Right.
So that's temporary, where you're just going to give all that money to content producers.
Yeah.
Is that a viable business model long term to actually then start, you know, taking your cut of that? And will there be enough left over for people to actually make money?
We've done the math on this and we think it's pretty good. We're actually giving more than the $5 technically now because we're seeding the system, but we feel good about that long term. And subscription business, if you can get to critical mass, it can be a very healthy business. I think what the system will allow for is the very best stuff to rise to the top and be rewarded, as well as for us to have a business on top of that. And it's not that different from other, you know, consumer media subscription businesses, which have built some very big companies and
right.
gotten a lot of content creators paid very well.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with five different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great, too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
You talk about stuff rising to the top, but if you going back to the ad-based model, if you look at, say, Facebook, that's an ad-based model, and it's a hugely powerful, but it kind of creates imperfect results. You talk about fake news and the kind of these filter bubbles. Why is it so hard to kind of make money? Is it the problem with the duopoly of Google and Facebook?
There's a distinction that is important, I think, in talking about ad-based models, in that there's ad-driven content and there's ad-driven distribution systems. In the latter, I would put Facebook, Google, and Twitter. The ads that drive those systems are not funding content. They're funding those systems, which provide all kinds of services for people. The problem is actually ad-driven content. So it's the most blatant fake news, you know, some of it's ideologically driven. A lot of it is profit-driven. It wouldn't exist if people couldn't make money by getting someone to click on those headlines, but you could say they're complicit and they're part of the same system. But where it relates is if you're a publisher, a content creator, and you choose to be driven by ads, or if that's your model, you are competing with them because you are selling attention and they're selling attention, and they are not paying to create content, and they have an incredibly efficient targeting and distribution method for attention. And so you're getting into a commodity business with the most massive, lowest cost producers in the world. And so you're probably in trouble.
Speaking from having been in newspapers for 15 years, I can tell you firsthand.
Yeah.
I've been through many rounds of redundancies. Yeah.
Another aspect that I don't think is super well understood is the programmatic buying. Because ads alone could be a non-commodity business, and they used to be more so. So a London newspaper, I want to buy these sophisticated readers who are based in London, and that's not a commodity that you're competing with people all over the world on, and so you could charge a premium for accessing those people. It was natural to think that would apply online as well. So if you can build a great brand by doing high quality content, and then you can sell advertising at a premium because it's associated with your brand, then you're in less of a commodity business, which is true, and a lot of people still do that. Programmatic buying is making that harder and harder, so people are buying less of the context that their ad is showing up in. They're just buying the eyeballs that show up.
And if those programmatic ads are effectively bought by an algorithm.
Exactly.
And so the big brands just say agency X buys X amount of eyeballs.
Yeah.
Just indiscriminate.
You're more likely, I mean, you can buy them on any parameters that you want, including sites, but you're more likely to define the types of people that you want to target than you are going to say the place where I want to. So if you're some fancy magazine and you used to sell, well, those fancy magazine readers also use Facebook and Google. And they're probably much cheaper. And occasionally they visit some, you know, cheap website, and they're cheaper to buy over on those places than in your fancy magazine. Then you're selling the same product that they are.
In that broader context, just looking at Twitter for a second, is Do you think there's any hope that that will, it will ever become profitable?
Twitter?
Yeah.
I, as a board member, can't comment on the future prospects of Twitter.
Otherwise, they'll throw you in jail.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Can you talk about why you guys ended up not selling it earlier this year?
No. It didn't seem like the best outcome for the company.
Right. And just this, going back to the kind of the broader context online and Twitter's place in it, and this idea of, you know, the internet, it's an amplifier of everything. It's also an amplifier of trolls. Is that something that worries you?
Yeah, I think historically we underinvested in the defense mechanisms. But the company is heavily invested in those mechanisms over the last 12 months, and I think there's substantial progress has been made. There's more to do. The whole industry is underestimated in those defense mechanisms, not entirely just about abuse, but misinformation. That's why the whole fake news thing happened.
Yeah, you see what's happening now with Facebook.
Exactly. Part of our ethos at Twitter was about connecting people who didn't necessarily know people. Like, it wasn't a social network. What people love about Twitter is connecting with people who they don't know. The architecture of the system, therefore, allows more interaction with strangers who may not be people you actually want to interact with. And so the architecture of the system caused it to be more likely place for bad actors to thrive. But
especially with the possibility of being anonymous.
Yes, right. Exactly. Anonymity, again, while other systems may say, well, that's a feature we don't want to have, for Twitter, it's been an important factor for many use cases, including people in oppressive regimes who are using Twitter as a way to coordinate and protests and all kinds of other things. It's a lot more complicated, I think, than other people. A lot of people, if they haven't thought about this deeply.
Well, it's a very delicate line, right?
It's a very delicate line, and it's complicated, and we can definitely do a better job. The solutions are often a lot thornier than people realize.
Yeah, well, because to your point around anonymity, it allows certain ideas and movements to happen that wouldn't otherwise.
Yep.
So do you think anonymity on Twitter is safe?
You mean, is it going to be?
In other words, like Facebook, it's very hard to actually set up a kind of a fake or an alias, mm-hmm. if you will. Twitter, it's pretty easy.
Yeah. I think pseudonymity, I don't know. I don't think, I'm not aware of any plans to change the ability to be pseudonymous, but it's slightly different than anonymity because you can still build a reputation over time and you still need to earn attention. So anonymous systems like Secret and Yik Yak and some of these other things that have grown very fastly have gone down in flames because they're not... anonymity has much bigger challenges. It also has some benefits. I think so far the cons of far outweighed the pros of truly anonymous systems.
Right. Right. And do you have any sense of why, and I don't know how answerable this is, but why the big platforms, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, were kind of unprepared for that kind of that darker side and the ability of those tools to actually just really amplify those voices? I mean, because having come back from London, this is a very distinct bubble from the rest of the world. I don't know if that has something to do with it.
I don't know either. I don't know either. can't really say. I think I don't know.
Don't know.
I don't know.
But you think that has the worm turned? That
in terms of attention to the to these issues, absolutely. I think it's a vibrant conversation in Silicon Valley, and it's tied with all kinds of other things, like awareness in general of diversity issues and equality issues and abuse issues, both online and off, is much, much higher even in the last year or two than ever. And I think that's a super positive thing. and it's going to take a while to create. They're all systemic issues that are not easy to solve, but I think the awareness is trending very positively, and there a lot of these things are unignorable, and the intensity of the conversation, it's grown much faster than the problem probably grew gradually, and then suddenly, especially after the election, everyone's talking about it.
It does feel, I mean, I've only been here since January, but there does seem to be a real kind of like light bulbs are going on all around the valley.
Silicon Valley is still a place where people come and are generally very idealistic, and I think more than other industries, and I think a lot of the world media and otherwise is saying to Silicon Valley, like, these guys with all this power and money need to be responsible actors, and because of this money and power. But compared to many other industries, I think the intentions and the ability are very, very high. In my history in Silicon Valley, in 20 years of working on these systems, haven't paid enough attention to many of the problematic aspects, but I do believe in the people and their ability to solve problems, and so I'm optimistic still.
Yeah, because it does seem like the kind of this tool was created and then kind of grew beyond everyone's imagination, and now there's a kind of uh-oh moment.
Yeah, but still combined, if there wasn't the optimism, we wouldn't have tried to do these things. These things are incredibly hard to do. It's not like, oh, we just tried some things and this thing happened. I mean, there's incredible thought and effort that goes into building any of these systems. And so I sort of look at it as the same problem as the internet as a whole. It's like we created these things. We thought lots of good things would happen. Lots of good things happened. Also, some bad things happened. Let's look at those bad things and see what we can do next. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, all of this stuff is very immature and it's very early still. It's changing incredibly quickly.
What was your worst day of work?
My worst day of work?
Mm-hmm.
My worst day of work was probably when I stepped down from Twitter.
2010.
Yeah.
Did you resign, or were you forced out, or why was that so bad?
I was asked to resign. Yeah, so I did.
Right. And at that time, Twitter was, it was still private, but you guys were kind of getting ready to go public.
Yeah, it was private for a couple of years after that, and Dick Koslow took over was my COO, took over as CEO, took it public, and he did a great job at that. But I was somewhat surprised by that move of my board.
But you and Jack are on good terms, clearly.
Yeah, we're good. I'm still on the board. They're doing good work.
Yeah. Do you think Facebook is good or bad influence generally?
No comment.
And that's it for another episode. I want to thank Ev for carving out a bit of time and sharing some of his highs and lows over the years, and it struck me after we spoke just how hard it is to make money online. So if you think about it, Twitter is still hugely loss-making. Odeo was a bust. Medium, I'm going to guess, is still deeply in the red. Makes you wonder where it's all going. Maybe Facebook and Google are just going to eat the world. But we soldier on, one podcast review at a time. That's right. You knew I wasn't going to say goodbye without the usual plea. So please stop in at Apple Podcasts and give a review. It helps. And if you're not already, subscribe. You can find us on Apple, Android, TuneIn, Spotify, we're everywhere. And of course, I'm also in the Sunday Times every weekend, in the newspaper online at thetimes.co.uk, and on Twitter at Danny Fortson. Thanks again for listening. Talk to you next week.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.